and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Tyler Smith.
And I'm David Bex. Sorry, I was just doing my Tyler impression. The listener doesn't know because I always edit it out. But before Tyler says hello every week for the past, how long have you been doing this? 14
almost,
years?
Almost 14 years.
Almost every week, Tyler goes, hello.
Yeah. Oh, it's so frustrating. Like when I do more than one lesson, like at this point, it's just me by myself. And I go in and there'll be times when I sort of lose my train of thought. So I cut and then I wait for a moment and then I start up again. And having to put those two together, I'm just like, am I like about to die? Why am I taking such deep breaths? This is, and you'll hear like you'll hear me start to say something like, oh, and then it gets cut off because it's the next clip. And it just sounds like, like I went to breathe and there was no air left. So yeah, but anyway, now David,
that's my favorite Harlan Ellison short story, by the way.
That was really good. Well done. That surprised me and I'm excited. It put me in a good mood. But before we jump in and find out who the hell that was, I did want to tell everybody that the book, the 101 best movies of the 2010s.
Battleship Pretension presents.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
Battleship Pretension presents the 101 best movies of the 2010s. It is done. It is in my possession. Literally, I was telling our guest that Jen is out of the house right now, so I was putting my kids to bed, and just as they were starting to doze off, sure enough, the UPS truck comes along and offloads 7 big boxes of books. And I'm very excited. And of course I then had to start all over again with my kids, but, I was very excited. And so I will let everyone know that at this point, obviously if you've pre-ordered the book, it's coming, it's on its way. I'm going to ship them out probably tomorrow, actually. For everyone else, if you haven't pre-ordered, the pre-order option is over. Now you can just order it like a person, like a regular person, like a regular person. You're regular. So just go to battleshippretension.com and click on the graphic on the left-hand side, and you can order the book for $14.99 plus shipping, in the US only. But I will say this, I said it to our patrons earlier. There have been some people internationally. The reason that we say US only is because at the moment, the only way to get the book is for us to ship it, and shipping internationally is exorbitant. And I'm looking for like a print. I'm looking into print on demand, which would still be fairly costly for international buyers, but probably still more feasible. So I'm looking into that, but it's probably not going to be for a while. I'm also looking into ebook options, but that'll be for a while. It won't be for a while. So if there have been some people that have said, I really want the book and I'm willing to pay the extra shipping, which is crazy to me. I appreciate that level of support, and I appreciate your enthusiasm for the book. So what I'll say is, if you are one of those people, don't take my saying that you're crazy. Don't take that judgment to heart. Go ahead and buy it. But, email me and we will work out the additional shipping cost.
Right. And keep in mind, if you can wait, we are hoping to get the print on demand thing, which again will still be a little bit more than what the people in North America are paying, but not that much more.
Yeah. Anyway,
$40 a book or whatever.
So we're very proud of the book. I love the design. I love all everything that the contributors contributed. So I'm very, this is our first book ever in 14 years. And for myself, I'm happy to be a part of it, as Dr. Venkman says in Ghostbusters. But anyway, just wanted to remind everybody of that. Then we can get to our guest.
That's your go-to quote. I'm happy to be a part of it, like Dr. Venkman says in Ghostbusters, because no one else has ever said that phrase. Everyone knows it's, it. It's the only thing that Dr. Franken says in Ghostbusters.
The cadence in my head is him saying, "I love this plan. I'm happy." It's that Bill Murray when he's enthusiastic, where it's like, "I think you're still being sarcastic." So anytime I use that phrase, I can't help but think of his, because it's a fairly mundane phrase, but in my mind, because it's so the cadence is so specific, it's like, well, I can't think of that belongs to him now. So I guess I should quote that character. But now, David, in the book, you and I did the most write-ups.
Wait, we have an ad to do.
Oh, first, that's right. Yes. Yes.
I'm going to tell you about tweakedaudio.com.
I think we just had an ad, by the way, as well. But
anyway, yes, that's true. Tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I'm using them right now, and I use them every day. Today, I was listening to... what should I talk about? Because I'm trying not to talk about metal all the time. But I guess I was listening to the new song Driver's License by Olivia Rodrigo, but I don't know anything to say about this song that won't make me sound fucking ancient. It debuted at number one on the Billboard charts because it like came up through TikTok, which is like how songs get popular now.
Sure.
It makes me feel like an old man to listen to it and be like, okay, this is like some sort of like shiny emo pop. I've heard this before. There's some nice turns of phrase in here, but it's sort of like, okay, when I was in elementary school, I lost my fucking shit over Nirvana. Right. Sure. But that's also because I was in elementary school. I didn't know about Husker Du. I didn't know about the Replacements. You know what I mean? This just like a sound that came out of nowhere, yeah, as far as I was concerned. And so I try to keep that in mind when something like this Olivia Rodrigo song becomes huge, is that like, this is a, like, she's like a Disney Channel star. Her fans, maybe this is their, one of the first, pop artists they've known about. So the song's good. I'm mostly baffled by its enormous success. But sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds that are available at a low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Tyler?
Yes.
You were saying about the book that the third, you and I wrote the most because we are the founders of Battleship Pretension. But Battleship Pretension, for all intents and purposes, has a third member by this point. Mm-hmm. He contributed the second most, or I guess third most.
Third most.
Us as a tie.
Well, I wrote one more than you, but that's fine.
Did you?
I wrote 26.
Oh, okay. So you wrote the most. I wrote the second most.
Yeah.
The third most entries in the book were written by Battleship Pretension editor at large Scott Nye. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Hello. Always good to be here.
Have you heard Driver's License by Olivia Rodrigo?
No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay.
Old man,
yeah. What do you
get out of here? This is a podcast for youngsters, for gifted youngsters.
I don't know what TikToks you're watching, Scott.
Apparently, the wrong ones.
Scott, have you seen the book yet?
No, I have not. Well, I've seen it. You know, the pictures on the Facebook and the so forth. I have not physically held such a thing. Whoa, look at that! There it is. There.
Yeah, that's super fun.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. Excited.
But this isn't a Patreon, we're not on video.
Well, I'm just showing Scott, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't want to spend too much time ogling the book.
I'm trying to create some theater of the mind here, David.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, I don't know. I don't know how great a job you're doing. It didn't work on me. So, what we're actually here to do is not to describe the book page by page to you. We're not going to talk about the book at all. We're here to talk about it's our annual kickoff to our end of year coverage, except it's 6 weeks late.
It's about time.
Normally the first episode, this is at least for the past few years, the first episode we do in the new year is Scott and I's top 10 of the previous year. But with everything sort of being shifted back and us tending to follow backwards from the Oscar ceremony with our end of year coverage, we're starting today, the day of recording, February 11th, 2021, to talk about Scott's favorite films of the year 2020, the year that was.
Yeah, it's been weird actually going into the new year, still thinking about the previous one. I don't know how you guys do it every year. They're keeping new movies coming out, and I'm like, well, I can't watch those yet. I still got this old year. Usually, you know,
I compartmentalize. Usually, you get used to it.
Pretty good for you, I guess.
But how weird is it that there are movies, like, obviously, I'm assuming you're keeping your list to actual 2020 movies, but neither of you was on the episode last week when Angie and I were talking about how weird it is for a movie like Judas and the Black Messiah to premiere at Sundance and then be eligible for the Oscars that are about to happen.
Yeah, I can't like get past that.
Like in most years, the Oscar nominations come out like before Sundance or around the time of Sundance. But it's weird to have movies on my 2021 list already that are also being talked about in the awards conversation.
I mean, I guess that's nice in some ways because it cuts down on the number of people who are like, this will be next year's Oscar front runner.
I love that shit. I love it because it usually isn't. But every once in a while, people are right about something about Minari or Call Me By Your Name that premieres at Sundance that has a lot of Oscar buzz and or at least awards buzz. And keeps
The only one that feels like it really went all the way like in the past 5-6 years was Manchester by the Sea, as far as like something premiered at Sundance and then eventually won an award.
Yeah. It won 2 awards.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying at least one.
Yes, sure. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's definitely, and as far as, look, people, they're not tuning in to find out about our draft,
I mean, you don't want to know. You would, if you knew how poorly I was doing this year, you would unsubscribe from this podcast. You'd be like, this guy does not know what he's talking about. I've done poorly in the past. This is a complete flame out.
But I didn't think you made bad picks going out of it. It's just the way it goes.
The nature that we're getting really granular and like inside baseball now, but the nature of this award season means that, so sometimes we do these swaps where if we have a pick on our team and it's not performing, you can swap it out for something that's still unclaimed.
Yeah. I just,
because of this stupid award season, I've swapped out 2 things that now if I'd kept them, I'd have more points. But no one was talking about Andra Day for months and months and months. And then like suddenly she gets like a Golden Globe nom and like a Critics' Choice nom or something.
Well, you had to expect that because the movie wasn't even coming out until February or something.
But I guess I kind of gave up on having Andra Day when, was it Paramount? Or whoever had it was basically like, we're not releasing this in theaters. This is going straight to Hulu. I was like, that's a vote of no confidence.
Ah.
This one is never going to get me any words, and so I switched it out, and suddenly Andra Day's racking up awards, or at least nominations.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that years ago I had Steve Carell for Best Actor for Foxcatcher. This is something I've said before, and the first few Critics Awards came out, and this was back before I realized how much of a disparity there can be between critics and industry. And the like critics weren't really nominating him for anything. And so like, I just like cut and run and went with someone else that was doing okay critically at the time, but got nothing as far as industry, which was Oscar Isaac for A Most Violent Year. And sure enough, then the industry kicks in and Steve Carell's getting nominated right and left. And if I had kept him, I would have won that year. It was very frustrating.
Well, I remember the time I really learned about the difference between Critics Awards and Industry Awards is that like at the halfway point, I was leading, I think in 2015, 2016, I think because I had Rooney Mara for Carol was the main thing, was like, like I was racking up points and I was, and then, but suddenly I was like a Looney Tunes character, suddenly realizing I was walking over thin air because the, then the industry awards came out and everyone forgot about Rooney Mara and I just like completely stalled out and everyone passed me.
Yeah. And like right now, so Scott is winning by a fairly wide margin right now, about 35, 40 points.
Yeah, that's right. But I am worried about the same thing happening to me because I got a lot of critics friendly stuff.
Yeah. And that's, and what's interesting is like, cause I'm behind about 40 points behind you, which to me feels insurmountable, but then those Golden Globes and those SAG nominations came out. And not so much Golden Globes, but like the SAG nominations came out and I was like, oh yeah, you do have, like, I genuinely thought, like, as always happens, just like with Willem Dafoe and The Florida Project, I thought Paul Racy was like a powerhouse, this unstoppable juggernaut for supporting actor. But no, we can't, we don't have any room for him with Jared Leto in there for the SAG Awards. And so I'm very interested to see how the next next couple months are going to go from a draft standpoint and other things.
Tyler, I was going to save this for the Movie Journal, which has already come out, but we haven't recorded it yet. Have you seen The Little Things?
No.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I know where it takes place. I'm aware.
Jared Leto visits the strip club at Victory in Bellingham, not once, but twice, which is so close to where, like, right down the street from where you used to live.
And right across the street from that, $2
second,
movie theater.
Second run movie theater.
But it's supposed to take place in Bakersfield, yes?
No, it takes place in Los Angeles.
Oh, does it?
Oh, at the beginning. So Denzel Washington's character is a Kern County deputy, like,
got it. Okay.
Sheriff's deputy. He comes to Los Angeles on some procedural work and gets tied up in a murder investigation.
I see. Okay.
So yes, it takes place in Los Angeles in 1990 for no reason.
Yeah. I imagine there's a lot of things in that movie for no reason based on what I've heard. But that's neither here nor there. What is here and now is Scott's top 10.
But also in the past, because it's dealing with last year.
What's up?
I don't know. I don't really have a way of preamble. Obviously, last year was terrible for everyone. It was just the worst year ever. And I'm not going to pretend like...
I did okay.
I got a couple kids.
Kids out of it.
Be one of those people.
Yeah. I actively am trying not to do that. But it's also tough because it's just like... It's like, yeah, it was a really... bad year, but it was good for me. So, you know what? Maybe I'll just keep my mouth shut for a while.
Honestly, personally, I've had worse years. I just, you know, try to be generous to the people.
Exactly. Of course.
I'm a man of the people, I
spent a lot of time counting my blessings that my year was much better than it could have been because I stayed employed. I live with someone that I love. I have a comfortable place. I also used, once I got over the first few months of just nonstop anxiety, I actually used the time to, like, we did some work around the house. I've like have started my workout and regime and like my health and skincare regime. I'm like, I've made the best of it, but I also think it might 2020 might still be the worst year of my adult life.
You've never looked better, David. That's what I say.
I know.
That counts.
But thank you.
I mean, the Zoom, to look, know, blurriness is doing a lot, but, you know, nevertheless.
You do look jaundiced, but you look all right.
All to say that the year's movies, I'm not going to pretend like it was the strongest year for movies ever, but I feel like we do the same conversation every year where people who don't see a lot of movies say it was a weak year, and people who see a lot of movies say a lot of good movies came out. And I feel like that's kind of the same thing this year, only more pronounced because it was just harder to keep up. I mean, I get it. It's hard to know what's out there. It's hard to find the motivation to watch things when they're just available all the time on demand or whatever. And I definitely saw fewer movies last year than I have seen as far as new releases go in over a decade easily. Usually I do like between 140 and 170. Last year I did exactly 99. I tried to make it to 100 and couldn't even talk myself into that.
But I want to know, what's the 2020 movie you couldn't talk yourself into watching?
I started but did not finish both Tesla and American Utopia.
Oh, okay. I would think you'd like American Utopia.
I was digging it so far. I just then I just didn't finish it.
I know you're not a Michael Almereyda fan, so
yeah,
Tesla is not the movie to win over non-Michael Almereyda fans. No, it's very much a Michael Almereyda movie.
Proving a tough row to hoe. I made about halfway.
You know, there's a certain 2020 documentary that you could have watched.
Who's to say I didn't?
Oh, fair enough. Oh yeah, all right.
We'll see if it made the list.
I was going to say, and with that, let's get to your worst movie of 2020.
Yeah. So this is a little awkward, guys, but I know we have on the podcast. No, I actually had trouble thinking of the worst movie I saw this year, because you really want the worst to be like the movie you saw where within the first like 20 minutes or so, you get that kind of like, ah, shit feeling where you can tell it's going to go wrong. And it just keeps going wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong. And the only one I could really come up with for that was George Clooney's Midnight Sky. And I believe David called out when talked about in the movie journal, the exact moment, which is when the little kid shows up and we find out she can't talk. And right away I was like, this is not going to go well for any of us.
Yeah. I'll reiterate what I said in the journal. Let's not forget the movie starts with the words 3 weeks after the incident on screen, which is a pretty big red flag.
I was less put off by that than you were. It was definitely a little like, okay, not so sure about that. But by the time the little kid showed up, that was when I really knew that it was going to get bad. And just like even that bad setup proves to be the establishment for a horrible creative decision that they reveal at the end that I won't get into, but it's just the most pointless twist you can imagine. And and if they just told the movie straight, there's a good story in there. George Clooney's trying to do his Leo DiCaprio thing, get real cold, real miserable. Could have all ended up pretty well. There's some exciting sequences, but it just felt like a bad merging of The Revenant. Yeah, it felt like a bad merging of The Revenant and Gravity with not that those are particularly good movies to begin with, but with neither of those movies' cleverness.
The Gravenant,
as it will now be known.
You're welcome.
So yeah, that's my worst. Overrated, I had plenty to choose from, but I tried not to pick on some of the smaller movies that had enough trouble finding footing this year amidst the pandemic and people's attention spans and all that. So I went with the largest movie that nevertheless I felt was overrated, and that was Disney and Pixar's Soul. I think technically it's Pete Docter and Kemp Powers' Soul. Weirdly, it's credited as director to Pete Docter and co-director to Kemp Powers because he didn't direct enough, I guess. I don't know. But I am not into most contemporary Pixar stuff, and this was not convincing me otherwise. I just think the animation style isn't that exciting. And I thought the whole first half of just constantly explaining what it was about was exasperating. And I really thought Jamie Foxx and Tina Fey are perfect examples of why you shouldn't cast celebrities in these things. They're just, every line reading is so overexcited and so overpronounced and not grounded in character. And it just feels like they are just trying to mug for the recording booth kind of thing. I was not into it.
So I haven't seen the film yet, but I'm curious, like in your view, like where does contemporary Pixar start?
Probably after Toy Story 3. Although like, I mean, I'm not too big on Wall-E and Up and Ratatouille, but those are still pretty solid. Mm-hmm. After Toy Story 3, it gets dicey. I think the only one I really liked was Brave. I didn't see Cars 3. I didn't see Finding Dory.
Did you see Monsters University, which I wound up liking?
Monsters University.
I liked it a lot more than I thought.
That's all right.
Yeah.
That's an okay one. I missed Coco, which I think was the one that people are really excited about. I know everyone loves Inside Out. I saw that, hated it. But I'll probably catch up with Coco at some point. Just when you guys remember when it came out and they were playing that like half hour short beforehand, the Frozen short?
Yeah.
Attached to the movie. That was the moment that I was like, there's no way I'm going to show up an hour before the movie actually starts. Just to go see Coco, which I'm not even sure I'll like.
Yeah.
So that ultimately turned me off, but I'll catch up with it someday.
I could see you liking Coco.
Yeah. It looks very visually dazzling at the very least.
I think I'm generally with you about contemporary Pixar, except that I do really like Inside Out. Partially because, as I like to remind people at every chance, it's a hockey movie.
Sure.
Soul, I can't remember what I said in the movie journal. I think I said it was pretty like batting 500 middle of the road Pixar stuff.
So you would agree that it is overrated then, because people are very high on it.
Yeah, I think my problem this year, and I'll have to like recalibrate. I feel like I have a worse sense of what the consensus of certain movies is.
Oh, sure.
This year, I think I've been spending less time on Twitter, is maybe just a part of it. Yeah, I guess I thinking about it, like, oh yeah, I guess Soul is like racking up a lot of awards, so people think highly of it. But I don't know. I guess people are talking about it like it's one of the best Pixar movies of the.
Yeah, the weekend it premiered, so. People were very, very into it. That's all.
I'm a big fan of Onward, and I wasn't expecting to be, but I liked it a lot.
Yeah,
I didn't see that one.
For underrated, I'm going with a trio of movies that are kind of connected by a common theme. And these, to be fair, might not even be good movies. I dug them, but open to the opposing side. And they're three studio movies directed by women, The Turning, Birds of Prey, and Wonder Woman 1984, all of which were kind of dismissed or outright disparaged. Some for some reasons that are probably pretty valid. I do think the racial politics in Wonder Woman 1984, pretty dicey, even if it's a small part of the movie. And for some reasons that I think were complete bullshit. I mean, most of the case against Birds of Prey is just that it's too feminine, as far as I can tell. And I think more and more, the real thing is that they just don't conform to what has been established for these kind of big studio release movies in these kind of genres. But a lot of those things were established over decades and decades and decades by male tastes. So what we're seeing is kind of a radical shift in priorities as women take the helm more and more and get more and more creative power. And that's probably going to have a few rough spots along the way. I think that's what we're experiencing, but I think it's also really exciting in a lot of ways. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in Birds of Prey and Wonder Woman and The Turning that is really different and really strange and really interesting that I just haven't seen from male directors with given these kind of resources. So I definitely am excited by what they point to. And I was really into each of these movies for their kind of freshness.
I haven't seen The Turning, but I'm a big fan of both of the superhero movies you mentioned. Especially, I think Birds of Prey has really grown. I liked it when I saw it. And the more I think about it, the more I like it.
I didn't care for it much when I saw it, but there's still visually, I think it's great. And I like a lot of those performances. Unfortunately, I think the best performance is Ewan McGregor, who is having more fun than any actor has ever had in any movie ever.
Well, partially because he's been so dead on screen for so long.
Sure.
It's like, wow, he's really into it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Probably okay. Down with Love was like the last like really vibrant performance of his. I'd say.
Yeah, I still need to see that.
Oh man, you'd love.
Oh,
it.
Oh, really? I do.
Yeah, that's a Scott type movie.
I know. I was like 16 or 17 when it came out, and I was like, kind of interested, but like it's hard to get a group of teenage friends together to go see Down with Love.
Right. Sure.
It's a homage to 60s sex comedies, guys. What the hell was I going to say though? Oh, I liked him in Ghost Rider. That was the last movie that I was really into him.
Oh, man.
Ghost Writer.
Yeah, I heard Ghost Rider and I was like,
yeah.
I mean, I hated that every moment of that movie. Did I block him out? Okay, Ghost Rider. No. I've got it. Yes.
Polanski, baby.
Mm-hmm.
As far as
that's a good transition.
Yeah. Maybe let's not work the word baby in the same sentence as Polanski.
Well, sure. We all have regrets this year, I'm sure. For honorable mentions, I just want to quickly run through five films that kind of in various ways upset the status quo in a year that was rife for that kind of thing. I guess this first one doesn't really, although it's a very aggressively weird movie. Abel Ferrara's Tommaso, which I logged in Letterboxd noting that I'm unsure whether or not I want to click the heart icon, and I'm still not sure if I really liked it, but Willem Dafoe undoubtedly gives to me the performance of the year. And I pitched this idea to Dave, and I still think we should do this podcast sometime, the idea of actors as auteurs. And
Dafoe's
performance here completely makes that kind of case. Like, he is inseparable from everything the movie is doing, not only from what he's doing within it, but like the whole way the movie is defined really comes as much from him as it does Ferrara. And despite the fact that it's like almost strictly autobiographical about Ferrara's like life at that point. But Dafoe really makes it his own in a very powerful way.
I'm so excited about that topic. I wish we could throw today's out the window.
Well, I'm sorry. Mine's just.
I know.
No, we'll do it soon.
Yeah. Tommaso rocks. As with last week with Angie, listeners, I'm occasionally going to chime in so that Scott has the chance to take a breather or a drink of water.
I do appreciate that. The other is a movie I just saw last night. It's called Build the Wall. It's Joe Swanberg's latest movie. The first I think he's made since he did that series Easy for Netflix. And this one, it's an hour long. He just made it and threw it up on Vimeo and YouTube. It's just there. You can log in and watch it. Anyone can watch it. And it's very much a return to like old school Joe Swanberg of like low grade tech, shitty sound quality, and a fair deal of erections, if you're into that kind of thing. And that's, I did that
weirdly,
just for
Tyler's face. Again, you guys weren't on the podcast last week. We talked about erections last week on the podcast as well.
Pro or con?
Well, I talked about a movie at Sundance that has a lot of erections in it. And I said, you know, if that's something that scares you off.
Sure.
No, that there's a lot of erections. Of course, I'm talking about Judas and the Black Messiah.
That's what got Daniel Kaluuya that nomination.
Yeah, it still has a stronger structure, I'd say, than his earlier mumblecore things, if that was your initial problem with him. If your problem was erections, then you're shit out of luck, I'm afraid. Third one's Hopper Wells, which I talked about in the AFI episode. I don't need to go into too much detail on, but it still doesn't have distribution, and it really should. It's a great movie. Fourth up, Sylvie's Love, which is a very old-fashioned kind of romance movie. Some people have gotten confused and chastised it for not being a proper melodrama, because it's not a proper melodrama. It's a straight-up 50s romance, just starring black people instead. Which is really kind of a role that they didn't get to have in the 50s. And director Eugene Ash was kind of inspired by looking through these old photos of his grandparents. You know, the legacy he'd inherited from the 50s was of nonstop like racial discrimination and terror and stuff. But he just found all these old photos of them just like happy and having these carefree days. He's like, I want to make a movie about that. And so he did. And it's really sweet and really lovely. You can watch it now on Amazon. And then the fifth is Natalie Erica James's debut film Relic. And this was the closest film to make my top 10 that didn't quite make it. It's a horror movie about three women, three generations, a grandmother, mother, and a granddaughter, played by Robin Nevin, Emily Mortimer, and Bella Heathcote. And it's the rare kind of female fronted horror movie that isn't about either sex or raising a child. It's about kind of reaching the middle stage of your life and the responsibilities that come with it. And then looking at your parents aging and eventually dying and how terrifying that is. And it's just I think they're the only three cast members in the movie. There may be a couple other people, but it's really interior and the production design is amazing and really, really freaky and unnerving. I think that one's on various streaming platforms, VOD, that kind of thing.
Which brings us into the official top 10.
Yeah.
All those other movies fell way short.
Way short, except for Relic, which fell just outside.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so number 10. So some days, you know, I like to think of myself a pretty pretentious guy. I like to really lean into the pretension of the podcast and embrace the artsy-fartsy stuff. But some days, it's a Saturday, and you're just practically crying because of a basketball movie, and that is The Way Back by Gavin O'Connor, which I had missed in theaters. I'd wanted to see because I'm a big Ben Affleck fan. And so I caught up with it when it hit HBO Max many months later on a Saturday morning, and it just hit completely my vibe, and I was extremely into it as far as like just having me in its grips, getting me to that emotional place. Nothing else this year could touch it. And as listeners might be familiar, Ben Affleck plays an alcoholic. He's very little left to live for tonight, except for going home to a big old fridge of beer and just slowly downing it. There's a great sequence early on where he opens his fridge and it's filled with dozens of cans of beer. And you're like, well, this guy's stocked for a couple of nights, and just one by one goes through each one that's in the fridge and just gets drunker and drunker with nobody around him to kind of catch him. And that's like as good of a night as he has to live for. Until he gets a call out of nowhere to come coach the high school basketball team that he once led to a championship. And kind of what the first two thirds are, kind of a very familiar, you know, down and out guy rising through the challenge, connecting with the kids and really like finding a way to make a difference. And it follows that path. And I would have been very happy if it stuck with that path the whole way, because definitely the emotional high point is, you know, when they win the big game and it all like all the rewards start paying off. But then it takes a left turn around there, and the arc kind of shifts, and it kind of, I don't really want to get into too much detail, but it really centers on kind of the great lesson that anyone who played youth sports learned sooner or later, which was that phrase, you know, it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. And it really becomes immaterial whether or not they win or lose. I'm not going to say whether or not they eventually do or how far the movie gets into their basketball season, but the point really comes home as far as the dramatic structure of the movie, that whatever difference, you know, whatever number of wins they rack up, it's not going to solve Affleck's alcoholism. He has to figure that out for himself and has to navigate that in other ways and has to find rewards beyond leading kids to a championship. And it really navigates it in a very moving way. And I was just really impressed with it. Affleck is as good as he's ever been here. I know there's been a lot of reading into it of like, oh, well, he sure has the experience. And, you know, I'm not going to cast aspersions. Maybe that's why, maybe that's not. He just has a real kind of grounded sense of being like a little bit out of breath, kind of has this defensiveness that springs to his eyes whenever people start to suspect that he's, you know, had a few too many or coming off one or whatever else. He just has such an innate sense of that character and is so well-rounded. And yeah, I completely loved it.
That's so exciting. When I first saw the trailer for it, because of course it's, to whoever cut it, to their credit, they didn't overplay the inspirational part, nor did they overplay like the really depressing Manchester by the Sea, Lonesome Jim. Oh, weird. Both Casey Affleck aspects. And so as a result, I was intrigued that like, how are they going to bring this together without dipping too far into one or the other? And it's like, it is possible. And I was really excited to see it. I mean, I missed it, but I definitely want to, every time I remember that it came out, I was like, oh, I should prioritize that, because it definitely looks like my kind of thing as well, if balanced right. And it sounds like it is.
Yeah, it really finds that balance really well. Much better than I was expecting. I was expecting it just to be like, well, basketball solves everyone's problems, why wouldn't it? And, you know, I love basketball and all, but there are limits.
Well, I didn't, this is another example of me being tuned out on discourse forever this year. I didn't even know it was a sports movie. I'm glad to hear that Gavin O'Connor is back to sports movies after Miracle and Warrior. He's good at, I'm assuming the basketball games themselves are well staged, because he has proven himself to be very good at staging sports within movies. Even though he took a break from it for a few years there, making The Accountant, and before that, taking over from Lynn Ramsey on Jane Got a Gun.
That's right. I forgot he did that. The basketball games are really well staged, and he also has a good feel for like how shitty a lot of Catholic high school basketball stadiums are, and kind of the various levels where you can see, you know, how rich the alumni are, kind of thing. So they do a really good job with the production design as well there. All right. Number 9, another one that I revisited just a couple of days ago, just to make sure it should make the list. And indeed, Lover's Rock deserves to be on anyone's list. Steve McQueen's, one of his entries in the Small Axe series. Shamefully, I've not gotten through all of them. I've liked the ones I saw, but Lover's Rock is definitely the standout for me. And so it seems for most. I definitely don't want to undersell that it is first and foremost an absolute vibe. Just a great groove all around. The music's great. The dancing's a blast to watch. The cinematography really captures it in a really exciting way. It's actually shot, I looked this up today, by the same guy who shot Skate Kitchen a couple of years ago. I don't know if either of you guys saw that, but it was a really cool skateboarding movie that kind of shot skateboarding in kind of a way I hadn't seen before. It got really like on the ground and like just took on different perspectives and different ways you could hold modern cameras to kind of elevate things.
Skate Kitchen is what led to the series Betty on HBO, right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's there's a series on HBO, 6 episodes so far, called Betty, about young women skateboarding in New York City. And I think it's created by the same person who made Skate Kitchen.
That would make sense. That's a cool movie though, Skate Kitchen. But yeah, it's kind of the same approach here, where like he just photographs dancing in a different way than I've seen before, which is very focused on like hands and kind of middle body movements. You know, you don't really see a lot of feet. there's not like a lot of really wide shots of all the groups together. It's very much about like the intimacy of everyone dancing together. But in addition to that, like that was kind of what I heard about it up front, that it's just like 70 minutes of people dancing. And that's true to an extent, but it's also really canny and perceptive about small ways that kind of major issues intrude on life. There's like, it touches on hot button stuff in really kind of glancing ways. You know, there's one part where there's a guy trying to get into the party who's maybe a little aggressive, but then they hear a police siren coming. It's like, well, we can't have this aggression on the street, because as soon as the police see that happening, they're going to come bust up this party. They're going to, you know, rough us up, you know, it's going to take a turn for the worse. So they have to drag that guy in. And it's just a quick, you know, 2 second bit that says a lot about kind of the ways that Black culture has to compartmentalize itself and kind of hide its small bits of joy. And yeah, there's another part where the woman who's the lead character tries to chase her friend down the street and kind of runs this group of white guys just hanging out. And that's another example of like, there's potential for violence just right there when she's trying to get down the street, but it's just a small little bit. Gets into that, gets into rape culture. And then there's further themes, just like family struggles and kind of everyday things that we all deal with. But it's all kind of backgrounded to this dance party, and not in a way that like diminishes from that party, but just kind of contextualizes it and gives it more texture than maybe you'd expect right away. And yeah, just flat out, it's just such a sweet, energetic, and celebratory movie. And when you think of like what an ensemble can do as like a unit that kind of breathes and moves together, this is a really incredible ensemble. And there, a lot of them, you know, are only really there to dance. They don't really have any characters to play, but they really add to the kind of the texture and feel of the movie. And it's a real blast.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it too. I'll save my thoughts on it for some time in the next couple months, I think.
Fair enough. All right. Number eight is Sofia Coppola's On the Rocks. I'm a longtime Sofia Coppola fan, as many of us are, of course. I was 17 when Lost in Translation came out. Perfect age for a movie to change your life. And it's one of those movies that did. And this, aside from the fact of the Bill Murray of it all, definitely has the same sort of flavor. It has more humor than she's had in any of her movies since then. But it also has a real kind of driving force behind it. Just kind of enough of a plot to kind of urge it along. As listeners may know, I have a definite taste for these kind of simple stories where nothing much happens, but it's just about people kind of figuring things out that are shot really well. And it is beautifully shot by Philippe Lesore, who also shot The Beguiled and Wong Kar-wai's The Grandmaster. And it's really just about Rashida Jones and Bill Murray kind of reconnecting through this sort of arch narrative of Rashida Jones slightly suspecting Bill Murray, really suspecting that her husband is cheating on her, and them kind of going through a kind of thin man adventure to catch him in the act. And Bill Murray has such a great way of kind of urging her along throughout the movie and always kind of getting her to do all these things she doesn't really want to do. And in addition to Murray just being so damn charming all the time, he has a real kind of sense of what this character might be hiding through his own humor, and the way that he pauses between like lines. Like Rashida Jones has all these parts, but she starts to call him out for things he's done in the past, and he'll kind of brush them off with a joke. But then when she comes up with something that really lands and really hurts and really makes a difference, he still comes up with a joke, but there's just a little bit longer where he's trying to figure it out. And the space that he and Sofia Coppola craft between those moments really defines the character in a really interesting way. You know, there's never really a moment where he kind of comes out and apologizes for all the hurt he's caused over the years and all that. But they kind of reach the understanding that I think a lot of us have to with our parents eventually, where we just look at each other and be like, this is what it is. You know, we'll move forward as best we can. And it's a really lovely bit of filmmaking that I think kind of gets undersold. It seems simple on the surface, but Sofia Coppola has such a great sense of economy and how much you can do with little moments. I mean, the opening alone, where she starts out at Rashida Jones and her husband Marlon Wayne's wedding, and just cuts between them sitting at a table to them jumping into, of course, it's a Sofia Coppola movie, of overly ostentatious swimming pool, and then immediately cuts to their home life of them picking up toys. And with that, you've kind of established like the immediacy of their relationships. And she brings that approach to every scene. You know, there's a character played by Jenny Slate, who's in the movie for, I timed it the last time I watched it, like a minute and a half total, but she creates this whole world for Rashida Jones's social life in that time. And yeah, it's just a really lovely, beautifully made movie.
Sounds like a good performance under 15 minutes to me.
I've got her on my list.
All right.
I still haven't watched that one, but I was 17 when The Virgin Suicides was released in theaters in the U.S. at least.
There you go. We've all been 17 before. Number seven. Oh, that I've been meaning to say where these movies are at. So The Way Back is on HBO Max now and also on VOD. Lover's Rock is on Amazon and On the Rocks is on Apple Plus, which, you know, they offer a free trial. Just do that. That's what I did.
Thank you. Thank you for doing that. Actually, that's very helpful.
For sure. This next movie is on the streaming service that we've all decided to subscribe to, which is, of course, Netflix. That is Charlie Kaufman's I'm Thinking of Ending Things. And I've been a huge Kaufman fan forever. And so it's no surprise to me that his latest movie is equally as masterful as anything that he's written or directed in the intervening years. This is kind of overtly about a young couple, Jesse Buckley and Jesse Plemons, who are going home to visit Jesse Plemons' family, his mom and dad, have a meal with them, and just kind of for her first time meeting the family. But as we learn in the opening narration, she is indeed thinking of ending things. She's thinking of breaking up with them at any moment. And so she's not that invested in making a good impression. And as one expects from a Charlie Kaufman movie, things just get weirder and stranger, and it starts to feel like they're maybe trapped there, and maybe they never left the place they're from, and maybe they don't exist, and who's to say. I think it does have a very clear narrative through line, and just based on conversations with friends and various reviews I've read, I think we all kind of agree on what it's really about and what's really going on. But what's remarkable about that is that it really doesn't matter. The central like feeling of the film doesn't rely on complete understanding of it. It really gets through kind of these feelings of loneliness and desperation and regret without really clarifying what is strictly happening within the film. And that's, to me, always been Kaufman's great gift. And I think this is one of his better efforts in that regard, that he can develop something that's completely surreal and strange that has some logic behind it that he doesn't entirely explicate, but which carries with it a great deal of feeling. And as with most Kaufman movies, an element I always forget that he's great at incorporating the way we incorporate movies into our own lives, the way we like quote movies kind of offhand or try to pose ourselves like characters we've seen before, or especially if you've been involved in productions, maybe quote lines from plays you've performed years ago. And they just these way these things, the way that art really always stays with you is kind of a through line in his films, and very, very much present here. And almost completely the emotional heft of it by the end. In addition to Jesse Buckley and Jesse Plemons, who two Jessies spelled differently though, Tony Collette and David Thewlis play his parents and are both as great as they've ever been. It was photographed by the same guy who shot Cold War. So it's just as beautiful as that might suggest. And it's edited by Kaufman's, I'd say longtime editor. He also edited Synecdoche in New York, and it has that same sort of like slippery feeling of just kind of, things are just kind of gradually slipping away and reality starts to make less and less sense, but it all kind of has this consistent momentum to it.
Yeah, I thought it was absolutely gorgeous and it shook me in many ways that I don't want to get into right now because there's other things I want to say about it that would be spoilery, I guess would be the word for it, so that I won't say, but I will point out that among all the other things that Charlie Kaufman is good at, the movie is also very funny.
Yes.
It's also very unsettling in many ways, but it's very funny. And David Thewlis is his argument, how do I know a painting is supposed to be sad if there's not a person in the painting looking sad? It's like very funny, but also to people who spend a lot of time thinking about and appreciating and loving art, that's a very frustratingly common, it's not always put into words like that, but it's a very frustratingly common way of superficial way of engaging with art that so made me laugh and made me kind of frustrated with the character as well.
Yeah, Kaufman has a lot of those laughs that are either also sad or like also kind of frightening. Like I love the way that Toni Collette's waving to them at the start from inside the house and she just can't stop waving, which is a very like energetic mom thing to do, but also like it goes on so long it's kind of creepy too.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
So what number was that?
That was number seven.
Seven. Okay.
Number six is also a little bit surreal and a little bit, I guess, creepy in its own way. Hong Sang-soo's Yourself and Yours, which I've talked about a billion times on the show. I know. We're all sick of Yourself and Yours. We got to get through the yearly Hong Sang-soo.
So no, what I'm saying is you've completely gone off the rails at this point. Like, I understand a movie, like, if it had premiered at a festival in 2019, but I saw Yourself and Yours 4.5 years ago almost.
So did I. So my rule for these kind of things, for those who are curious, my rule is as long as a movie is released within 5 years of its premiere date, then that still counts for this year.
Like, if it's actual, like, commercial release to the public in the U.S.
Yes, because my top 10 list is distributed stuff only. I got some festival faves, you know, logged in the back for next year, but I only go by distributors. So,
So just so the listeners know, so they're not lost looking, where's the Yourself and Yours from 2020? This is a movie that premiered, I don't know what festival it premiered at, but premiered in 2016, but was only released to U.S. audience, regular U.S. audiences, I guess, in the year 2020.
That is correct. So you can watch it on, there's some digital cinema platforms. If you go to Cinema Guild, their website, they'll link you to them. I think you can watch it on Mubi right now as well. So there are ways now to see it, which wasn't true years ago, which is why it couldn't be on any other top 10 list. Though it deserves to be because it rocks. So it's interesting now to look at it and kind of contextualize in the films Hong's made since then. He's made probably five or six films since then. And he had come off a run at the time of these very, like, highly structured films with repeating scenes and incidents, which really came to a head with Hill of Freedom and Right Now, Wrong Then, which are kind of like maddening in their structure. Good movies, but very maddening. And Yourself and Yours has an element of that. It's about a man who's, his friend tells him that he saw this man's girlfriend out. She had a wild night out, and he seems to be presenting in a way that, like, maybe she'd be a little suspicious of her. And he confronts her about that, and she completely denies it and breaks up with him. And in the intervening weeks, he starts to see her everywhere, or maybe it's duplicates of her. And there's either she's multiplying, or there's a twin situation, or it's hard to say because it's a slippery, surreal Hong Sang-soo movie, but it's really very much about, like, the regret of miscommunication in relationships and the regret of letting go of a relationship too soon. And I've seen it a few times, and it's really, really an effective film. And I would say still, you know, it's up to, either that or Hotel by the River is his best for me.
And again, I feel like a broken record because I just said this about I'm thinking of ending things. But if I worked at a video store and I had to decide what category to put Yourself and Yours in, other than, I guess, it would be foreign, I would put it in under comedy. Like, the way that Scott, I think, described it doesn't make it sound very funny, but a lot of it is very there's a certain broadness, I think, to the setups and the framing, and the use of zoom lenses is done in some ways that are not, they're not like poking, prodding Robert Altman zooms. They're kind of comedic zooms. I don't think the movie is as good as Hotel by the River or On the Beach at Night Alone, but I liked it too, I guess. I also saw I always bring this up because I saw it. I took the day off work because I had a bunch of, like, sick days. But I took the day off work during AFI Fest, and they showed Yourself and Yours. It was its second screening. It was like a Monday at like 11 a.m. or noon, and they showed it at the Egyptian because I think they just, like, we have the Egyptian. We need some place to put the second screening of this Hong Sang-soo movie. I've never been to a screening of the Egyptian that was so underattended, like a Monday
at
11:30 in the morning for a Hong Sang-soo movie. It was there were like a dozen of us.
That's almost like too big a screen for Hong Sang-soo. All right. Number five, getting back into the studio fare, Lee Wan L's The Invisible Man, which I talked about on kind of the halftime episode we did back in June or July, whenever the hell that was.
It was July.
Judges July.
Well, I mean, I can't believe like it. Everything still feels like it's the same. So, but yes, that was 7 months or whatever.
Indeed.
7 months ago.
All right. Yeah, this is Lee Whannell's second film as director with Elizabeth Moss in the lead. And as far as like those great Friday night studio films, which are so few and far between, I think only Gone Girl from the past 10 years really stands up to the level the Invisible Man is working at. Just the marriage between what Whannell's doing with the camera and the sound design and what Elizabeth Moss is doing on screen is really, really incredible and really, really a high wire act. And, you know, there's that Ernst Lubitsch quote, which I tried to find attributed, but I'll just believe it's true because it sounds good, where he said, there's 1,000 ways to point the camera, but really only one. And it's something, you know, you don't always see directors go with. They'll shoot a lot of coverage and kind of piece it together piece by piece. But here, every shot has a real intention behind it. And, you know, it's not the right shot because it is symmetrical or because it goes on for a really long time. Although 1L uses both really expertly here. It's just, you can just feel it. It's just the right shot because it's the right shot. And sometimes it has a very clear distinction. And sometimes it just feels strange and perfect in ways you can't quite put your finger on. And, you know, moment for moment, I couldn't get over how well this movie was made and how thrilling it is at every point and how insanely good Elizabeth Moss is and how vanity free she is in her gradual and eventual complete descension into madness over being terrorized by her now invisible ex and aggressive ex-boyfriend.
Yeah, it is currently in my top 10 as well. And though I still have a number of movies to see, I can't imagine it falling out. Like it is just so expertly made. And it's interesting what you were talking about in regards to just the instinctive way that he knows how to place the camera, not to suggest he didn't put a great deal of thought into it, but like, how can something be intuitive and meticulous at the exact same time? That's how the film feels, is because you've got these two different perspectives. You have the perspective of a person who's becoming increasingly unhinged and another person who is very, very meticulous in their plans and in their actions. And you put those two together and it's a wonderful, because the characters are often in the same frame at the same time, even if we don't know it. And and it's a wonderful drama, a wonderful horror, a wonderful suspense. It's just like, I'd say it's damn near perfect, actually.
Yeah.
It's not a thing I say lightly.
And the whole conceit just speaks to like trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder so well. Like, even before he could be in the frame, he is in the sense because he's taking up space in her mind.
Exactly. Yes.
And so there are these shots early on where he'll just pan to nothing in the room, and whether or not he's in there is kind of immaterial because in her mind, he's still taking up that space.
Yeah.
And that is currently on HBO Max and VOD should listeners want to see it. So number four, speaking of invisible abusers, we have Kitty Green's The Assistant. This is a movie I saw it theatrically because it came out in like January or something. And I liked it, but I wasn't like completely bowled over by it for a couple of reasons. One, I think it has a really bad title. I hate just kind of like non-descriptive, like, oh, the assistant, because it feels like she's supposed to define like all assistants everywhere. And like, this is just what an assistant is defined by this film. And I thought it was
kind of... We all have our own pet peeves.
Do you like this title setup or what do you mean?
I was just thinking about how I am skeptical of titles that start with words that end in ing.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean?
And I don't like, as we've talked about on here, like whenever somebody titles their movie American some whatever that is, it's just like, man,
that's funny. So we honestly do all have our things.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, how can you watch this movie, many movies, and not build up some things? And then, so it has this whole conceit. So Julie Garner stars as the titular assistant who has just started. It's like 5 weeks in or so in this job, working as an assistant to a big, powerful movie producer who's, has his fair share of skeletons in the closet, and the whole company is kind of covering for his indiscretions and his harassment issues and all these other kind of derelictions of duty and abuses of power and everything. I think the movie was over promoted when it came out as being like the behind the scenes of the Harvey Weinstein story, because, you know, I don't know all the details there, and I don't think it's fair to tag that with the movie, in part because it overly sensationalizes what is actually a very common occurrence, which is, you know, the way that people in power abuse and exploit their power and the way people below them feel exploited by that. And so I thought when I first saw it that it kind of copped out by keeping him off screen. It's kind of a way to like make him more than he is, more of a boogeyman. But the more I thought about it throughout the year and then watching it again, that really does speak to the way, the effect that those kind of bosses have in those environments. And I've worked in offices like this. I certainly know the feeling of like, if you see them, it kind of diminishes the power that they hold over the employees because it humanizes them. And to the employees and the whole system that covers up for them, they have decided that he is more than human, or else he wouldn't be worth all the effort. And it really is about that whole system propping him up. And it's much more about the way that people excuse that behavior than the way that behavior actually happens. You know, you see all the little machinations that make it possible for someone to retain that kind of power, and the excuses people make all over the place, up and down the food chain, regardless of gender, regardless of anything, in order to justify their presence there. And in a very subtle and very canny ways, it kind of makes Julia Garner's character culpable in this whole operation. You know, even there's a fine scene where she, you know, kind of starts to try to report it to HR, and HR, as HR tends to be, is more interested in defending the company than it is in really helping the employee, and doesn't give her any relief and just gives her every reason to not go with it. But the way that Julia Garner plays that scene, you get the sense that she's not purely reporting it out of the goodness of her heart, or not really even reporting it just out of self-defense. She seems a little ignored by the whole operation. She seems jealous of the advantages that this new girl at work is getting because she's more favored. There's a really interesting kind of subtext to the whole scene, and Julia Garner's character kind of, not in any overt way, but she gradually takes on kind of the aggression that she sees around her and that she sees as making other people successful. It just takes place over the course of one day, and Kitty Green, who wrote and directed the film, is very smart about not developing too much into that. You just get little snippets of pieces that you have to add up and put together and kind of get a sense of this place and the sense of her trajectory within it that might not change the course of things at her company, and she might just become another cog in this machine. It's very undecided what her ultimate fate will be, but it gets so much of the texture of those kind of places right, from the kind of drab interiors to the kind of way people behave as though they're trying to be helpful, but they don't really want to put themselves too much on the line. It's just a really well thought out and well imagined movie.
I haven't seen it, but Julia Garner is the shit. I would recommend anyone watch the first Dirty John miniseries with Connie Britton and Eric Bana and Julia Garner and Juno Temple. And apparently I don't know if it's real or not, but there are rumors that Julia Garner is going to be playing Madonna in a Madonna biopic.
Oh, totally see that. Be
super cool. And I know a lot of people know her from Ozark, which I have not seen. When I think of Ozark, I think of the Onion headline: Netflix algorithm suggests viewer who liked Ozark might like pretty much anything.
Yeah, it's certainly people really like the show, and there's a lot to like about it, specifically Jason Bateman and Laura Linney, but she, I think, is really one of the highlights. I watched the first season, I think one episode of the second season, and I was like, I think I get this and I'm good. But she definitely, like, it's the thing that got her recognized, and I'd say understandably so. I'm not sure if I'd say the show is worth watching just to see her, especially because there are other good performances, but she is definitely a highlight of the show.
Cool. And I just looked it up. I had forgotten this phantom rumored Madonna biopic is said to be penned by Diablo Cody. I think, I'm not sure. We all hated her for a while, and then I feel like there's been like a lot of revisionism. I don't know.
I mean, I like Jennifer's body and I like her script for young adult. I don't think Jason Reitman's direction does the script any favors, but
yeah, young adult is the one I think that, that turned me around on her. I never saw Jennifer's body. I ought to. But yeah, I didn't like Juno, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. And I didn't really like, well, this is the last one they did together. Started with a T.
Tully.
Tully. Didn't really like that.
Yeah, I didn't see that one.
Cool. So that's on Hulu and various VOD platforms. Number three.
I think it's on Canopy as well, by the way. Really? The assistant. I believe so.
Well, good for Canopy.
Yeah.
They're getting some high profile movies these days.
They really are. Yeah.
I just watched Miss Juneteenth on Canopy.
Oh, that's a good movie.
And I saw that I think Beanpole is on there. And yeah, it's Canopy is turning into a really nice little streaming service.
Thank you.
Brought to you by.
Yeah. Your local library. Cool. So number three is Andrew Ahn's Driveways. I thought I heard a about to speak noise.
Anyway. I just guessed because I also love this movie.
Yeah, it's pretty great. It's practically everything I want from American independent movies that we so rarely get. Just is simple stories, but people with commitments and bills to pay and just trying to make it through the next thing in life. It is about a woman played by Hong Chau. Her name's Kathy. She's tidying up her late sister's house so she can sell it, only to find upon arriving that her sister was a hoarder who didn't pay her electric bills. And they really tease out the details. The writers and director Andrew Ahn really tease out the details in a really subtle and effective way where we kind of gradually find out that they weren't all that close. And she being suddenly confronted with what her how her sister had been living over the final years of her life proves kind of quietly devastating. It's a really effective portrait of kind of adult relationships and the way people become estranged from each other, which then ties into what her son is going through. You know, he's just there. He doesn't really have anything to do. She has to work remotely all day and then clean out the house kind of whenever she has time. They don't really live in the town, so he has no friends there. And so he just kind of gradually befriends the next door neighbor, played by Brian Dennehy, who's a Korean War veteran and a widower who's nearing the last act of his own life and is also kind of isolated and doesn't have a lot going for himself, but is very happy to look after this kid. And the relationship they form is so moving and so well wrought without being... It kind of, I guess you could say it kind of tips over in a sentimentality at the very end, but by that point, it's so restrained all of that, that it earns Brian Dennehy's final speech so well. And that speech he gives is so overwhelming and so moving. And I really wish that Dennehy had caught on more in kind of the conversation of the great performances of the year, because it really was an incredible kind of capper on his career. Also, interestingly, the characters weren't intended, Hong Chau's and her son's, they weren't intended to be Asian American in the script. Which is by two white writers, but somewhere along the way they brought in Andrew on it, and he just suggested it, and all the right people said yes in order to make that happen. Not only does it kind of bring it closer to himself based on what I've read in interviews, just kind of his own experience, as he notes, is a way to kind of physicalize their feelings as outsiders. You know, they're cleaning out this house in the middle of Michigan, not exactly a hub for the Asian American community, and everyone around them is white, and they're naturally going to look at them as outsiders just by virtue of them not being from the city, but also just their minority status very much puts everyone like at a slight remove. And it's an interesting way to kind of texture the film, and also just gives Hong Chau a great role. Finally, she's not playing the weirdest person you ever met. Although I've always liked her in those roles, but she's really, really good here.
Yeah. There's not much else I have to add except that I like the slice of life scenes of Brian Dennehy and his buddies at the, I guess like VFW or whatever. But
One where of veterans go by, to play bingo.
Yeah, and one of them is played by the great Jerry Adler.
Oh yeah,
and then they actually have there's a standalone scene. They have their own scene at the grocery store together, which is also a very affecting scene.
Oh yeah, and before kind of Cody's allowed to hang out with Brian Dennehy all day, he's shipped to various like neighbors' kids' houses. And as someone who's often shipped to neighbors' kids' houses after school and stuff growing up, it really gets a feeling of just being in a seemingly stranger's house, but just the shittiest kids you've ever met in your life. That's a nice bit of texture that I don't often see in coming of age movies.
Yeah. And Christine Ebersole plays the mom of the neighbor kids. And yeah. She's an actress that I like, familiar recently to viewers of Search Party as Portia's mom.
Oh, I still need to catch up with Search Party.
Oh, yeah. Well, just got renewed for a fifth season. So
I know you can find it to catch up on.
Yeah.
All right. Number two is Hirokazu Koreeda's The Truth. This is his first film made outside of Japan. And I think really, at least of the handful of films of his I've seen, I haven't caught up with some of his earlier work, but this is one of his best, I think. It helps that it stars, you know, some of my favorite actors, Juliette Binoche, Ethan Hawke, and Catherine Deneuve. Binoche and Deneuve, despite being two of the greatest French actresses of all time, have never been in a movie together. And it almost seems like they've been waiting for parts this good or a relationship this good to play. She plays, much like Deneuve herself, a legendary French actress. Her character's just published her memoir, and Juliette Binoche plays her daughter, and Ethan Hawke, who plays Binoche's husband, come to visit to kind of celebrate and drive her to and from the set of the film she's working on. And all of these elements kind of just bring her into bring Deneuve into confrontation with how she's aged and how close she is to the end of both her career and her life, and how her diminished status that she's worked so hard to attain maybe won't really matter as she nears the end of her life. You know, she's has this kind of uneasy relationship with her daughter and doesn't really have the emotional resources, I guess, to fortify it. And the way the two of them play that relationship is really sharp. I mean, they're both just very cunning and observant actors. And a lot of the script is apparently not quite improvised, but sort of built around the actors themselves and kind of how they built the characters on set and kind of adjusted day to day to accommodate that. And you can tell that Koreeda has a real insight into both of their kind of personas and what they're capable of. It was also shot by Eric Gauthier, who's a great French cinematographer. Definitely has an eye for this kind of sentimental stuff. He shot Summer Hours and A Christmas Tale. These great kind of blown out images that lend a sort of surreal shimmering quality to all the scenes. And everyone in the cast is just so, so good. Has a kind of deep supporting cast of people who are probably familiar to people who watch a lot of French movies and who I certainly can't name. But I was really very moved by this when I saw it at AFIFS last year. And then when I saw it again, and it's on VOD and Showtime for anyone who wants to catch it.
I like this movie a lot too. The, we should say the title, The Truth, probably refers to a lot of things, but it's also a bit ironic because Catherine Deneuve's character's memoir is full of lies, which causes a lot of friction. I also love Ethan Hawke in it. I still feel like an Ethan Hawke defender, even though I think over the past five or so years, like,
yeah, I think people have caught up.
People have caught up, but I still feel like I want to defend him. And I like how, given the kind of characters who really made his name in the 90s and like Before Sunrise and Reality Bites and stuff like that, how good he is in this character in this movie at playing a character who's usually at a disadvantage, usually like trying to catch up with the conversation. He's playing a very person who's in a place where his insecurities are on display and can't be hidden because of his outsider status as the American.
Well, and especially the language barrier, because he speaks like the tiniest bit of French of anyone who's probably married to a French person.
Yeah. I think it's a really good performance.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Number one. We did it, guys. Got all the way to the top.
All right. Well, wait, did we say where were the last couple viewable?
The Truth is on VOD and Showtime. Oh, Driveway is same deal. VOD and Showtime.
Okay. All right. Showtime. So now that's the buildup. To number one. Here we go. The curtain falls. Go ahead.
All right. So as far as I can tell, I can't remember if I've ever or when the last time I would have put a debut film as number one. And it's not that I'm opposed to debut films. It's just that, you know, it's rarely their best effort and they usually get better. And there's usually plenty of films by more experienced directors who are, you know, better at putting forward their vision and ideas and all that. But it's a strange year for a lot of things, and why can't it be a strange year for this? So my number one is Shannon Murphy's Baby Teeth. Now, there are a couple heavy hurdles to get past with in considering Baby Teeth and in considering whether to watch it. One of which, bad title. It's called Baby Teeth. Very off-putting. I understand.
All one word, too.
Yes. I understand why you would not want to watch such a movie. The other hurdle is its premise. It is about a 16-year-old upper-middle-class girl with cancer who falls in love with a 23-year-old drug addict. I get why that premise sounds very boring and dull and not that exciting. And to boot, she has a father who is a psychiatrist who's kind of largely checked out of raising his daughter, and her mother, who's maybe overly invested in raising her daughter, but her is kept on a heavy dose of pills via her psychiatrist father. So it has all these elements that are very like familiar indie tropes that are not that inviting because they've been so worn to the ground by so many lesser films. But what this movie certainly has to start with is a great cast. Eliza Scanlon, who's probably familiar to most of us from Little Women or those of us who saw the HBO series Sharp Objects. She was really the highlight of that series. And she plays the lead, the girl in question. Her boyfriend is played by Toby Wallace, who I don't know anything about. I think he's kind of a newcomer and better known to the Australian stage scene for whatever that's worth. But her parents are played by Ben Mendelsohn and Essie Davis, which is
throwing shade at the Australian theater.
No, I'm just saying, like, hard to develop an overseas rep based on that. But her parents are played by Ben Mendelsohn and Essie Davis, which should count for something around here, I should think. And the whole cast.
She's a BP award winner.
You're damn right.
Sorry, I didn't, not that anyone was necessarily missing me, but I had to mute myself for a while because the cat was making a lot of noise outside my door. So, but I definitely wanted to chime in and remind everybody that Essie Davis won Best Actress for The Babadook several years ago for the BP Award. And don't worry, everyone, the BPs are still coming just later like everything else.
Hell yeah. The cat just wanted to chime in on the truth, just really feeling, wanted to support the Ethan Hawke love. So yeah, this is adapted from a play, but you'd really never know it. Unlike the vast majority of stage adaptations, it's not about like presenting the play just as is or doing sort of a theater plus where they take all the lines and just set them in the shopping mall or whatever. It takes the central drama and reimagines it for the screen, while still retaining kind of the intimacy of the stage, which Shannon Murphy achieves by doing kind of a lot of interesting close-ups. It really reminded me of kind of Wong Kar-wai cinematography, where there's kind of this wandering camera that keeps going closer and closer to the characters so that they're really kind of, you know, practically right in our laps. They're really right up in our faces, and the actors are really inventive with what they do with the close-up. Eliza Scanlon in particular has a way of kind of playing to and with the camera that isn't like overly winky or cute or anything, but kind of draws you in closer to her experience of the scene. And it's just really sharply written, very funny. The characters spend most of the film making the wrong decisions, which the film doesn't condemn them, but it's also not non-judgmental of them. The feeling is really like when you've confessed that you've done something bad to your parents or your spouse or someone who loves you, and having them kind of embrace you for it and love you all the more for it, and just like draws you closer to them. The mistakes they make humanize them and add texture to them. They're not forgiven for those things. They're not condemned for those things. It's just the fact of this strange experience they're having, a strange point in their life, and the way that Mendelsohn and Essie Davis, the parents, try to kind of give Eliza Scanlon room, but not too much room in this relationship that they very much disapprove of, but also they want her to have whatever she wants because she's going through this horrible ordeal. And yeah, it's a tough film to really sell because I recognize that it has a lot of seemingly off-putting elements, but I haven't seen some, especially in a debut film, something this funny and fresh and consistently inventive. I really didn't know what it was going to do aesthetically or dramatically from one moment to the next. It kept me always on my toes. And it's a really, really strong film. It's on Hulu and VOD right now.
All right. That's very exciting. Very exciting. A lot of, yeah. And a lot of good recommendations. And I don't want to try and like cheer people up about an unfortunate year, but like, especially like from a theater going standpoint, like if you're like theaters being shut down and all that, but it's kind of neat that your entire top 10 is available right now.
Yeah,
people sure. can go and find it. It's not like there's some stuff that's still in theaters, but only in certain cities. Like listeners can go and watch all 10 of your favorite movies right now if they wanted to. And that's kind of exciting.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see the way that adjusts in the years to come whenever theaters become a thing again, whether or not they'll keep pushing things out in sort of a at home platform.
Yeah. But no, that's I'm as always, like there are a lot of movies I haven't seen this year, especially just having so little time. But they all sound very interesting to me, and hopefully the listeners are interested as well. So thank you very much, Scott, as always.
Thanks as always for having me. I'm glad my internet held out. It went down 3 times today, so it was only a matter of time before.
Indeed, yeah. It knew.
Fellowship Retention is charmed, blessed once again.
Yeah, that's it.
Exactly, yes.
So, well, thank you for being here, Scott.
Yeah, thanks as always.
Let's see, you can find me at battleshipretention.com. That's you can find us at battleshipretention.com, where you can find reviews of plenty of the movies that that Scott mentioned were reviewed by one or both of us at some point over the course of you have to go back quite a ways to find Scott's review of yourself and yours.
It's back there.
This week on the website, by the time you're hearing this, I believe I will have watched and reviewed The Mauritanian. We'll see how Baby Yoda does on in the
disapproved
in the courtroom scenes. All right, I'm at
never have objections been so adorable.
Yeah, you can email me your objections to that joke at david@battleshippretension.com. You can email Tyler at tyler@battleshippretension.com. You can follow me, David, on Twitter at debut pretension. You can follow Tyler on Twitter at Tyler Pretension. Tyler, do you have anything to plug?
I think I might have said this a couple weeks ago when I was on, but over at More Than One Lesson, I did an episode with Will Ryan and Katie Lee, two veteran voice actors, and it was a lot of fun. When you listen, it's one of those things, like when you listen, you'll be like, whoa, wait, I know that voice and have known it for a long, long time. And that's always fun for me. As David, as you know, I'm a sucker for voice actors. I really enjoy talking to them. So yeah, you can find that at morethanonelesson.com. And obviously, everybody check out the book.
Yeah. And Scott, where can people find you should you want them to?
Yeah, you can find me, I guess. Why not? I'm out there on Twitter at Rail of Tomorrow, Letterboxd, Battleship Pretension. When David's not reviewing everything, I'm sure eventually he'll let something go for the rest of us.
He's got to crack sometime.
I don't understand what I like. I'm not really doing anything differently. I don't know. I don't know how to navigate this any better than anybody else.
No. If you're happy, I'm happy. I'm just, if the listeners
I am miserable, are... but, okay,
terrific. I'm glad it's working out for you.
It's working.
Yeah. It's, it felt really bad when we were working on the book. Cause, I was kind of the one tasked with emailing people being like, hey, don't forget that your write-ups are due and blah, blah, blah. And then I felt bad emailing David. Cause like he's carrying the entire fucking website on his shoulders single-handedly. And it's just like, excuse me, can you please get these in? Thank you.
Well, not single-handedly, obviously.
I suppose not. But as far as written stuff,
I've still got my movie journals happening.
Scott's got the movie journal. Scott covered AFI, which I know at this point was 4 months ago, but life is a blur.
Yeah.
You can find his review of Hopper Wells, which was mentioned.
That's true.
At battleshippretention.com. Plenty of fun stuff at battleshippretention.com.
Mm-hmm. We're all having Absolutely. A good time.
And a review of The Mauritanian, which is a Kevin MacDonald film. Kevin MacDonald film. So I predict, I haven't watched it yet. I predict I will find it competent.
So, what's the worst, if as far as bad titles, is Baby Teeth or The Mauritanian worse?
I can at least pronounce Baby Teeth.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I'm with you.
That's a word I can pronounce.
I still think my least favorite movie title of 2020, especially for a movie that I actually liked, is still The 40-Year-Old Version.
That's yes, bad. Absolutely.
Yeah. It really makes me angry.
That title. Also, I did not like that movie.
Oh.
Stay tuned to the, for the movie journal. I guess people by this time, people will have already heard the movie journal. Yeah. Yes. But,
and also I talked about 40-year-old version of the movie journal 2 months ago.
I know, but I didn't. And now I'm going to get to. Yeah.
Oh, I see. I see. I just understood what you were saying.
So, yeah. But, yeah. Oh, Scott. Now, I mean, we have to end. So at some point in the near future, I would like to know your thoughts on 40-year-old version, for like what you didn't like about it and that kind of thing. So,
all right.
But anyway, in the meantime, thank you so much. Oh, wait, no, this is David's part.
Oh, thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.